And I'll be back in Los Angeles next Monday. You know, as you get older, you begin to think about death a little bit more than you did when you were in your 20s or 30s. Dr. Sam Parnia with his earth-breaking research into near-death experiences. He's our special guest next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, sit back and relax. If you're driving, don't relax too much. Dr. Sam Parnia, leading expert on near-death experiences. He spends a lot of time in hospitals in the New York area as well. He founded the Consciousness Research Group, chairman of the Horizon Research Foundation as well. He has been on numerous programs and documentaries. His book is called What Happens When I Die, and he is really one of the leading researchers into near-death experiences, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Sam, how are you, Doc? Good to have you with us.
Good, thank you. Good to be with you.
Tell me your interest in near-death experiences. How did this all happen?
Well, I became interested in what happens really essentially to what happens when we put people die in near-death experiences. When I was finishing medical school, when I was 22 years old, and the reason was that multiple things really that had happened to me at that time. Predominantly that I had been going to see people have a cardiac arrest. A number of patients of mine had had one of these and had died in front of me. And at that time, I didn't know them until I got to know a patient of mine very well personally. And I witnessed him have a cardiac arrest, and he died in front of me. And during this time, I was looking at what was going on and thinking to myself, I wonder what's happened to this conscious thinking person that I was talking to half an hour who was so wealthy. He was a very sweet man. He was a very nice man. His whole family. And the doctors tried in vain to save him, but it was impossible. He was bleeding very heavily. And I watched as he basically on the monitor as his heart slowed, and then it went into this flatline rhythm, and there was nothing they could do. And I remember thinking in the middle of all this chaos, what's happening to this person? Is he conscious? Is he able to hear us? Is he able to see us? And that was essentially what started it out for me. I wanted to know what happens. And I realized that a lot of decisions are made based upon what doctors think happens when patients die, but we had no objective knowledge. And that's really what started my interest.
Now, and in this particular case, he flatlined. Did he come back, or he died and that was it for him?
No, he never came back. But what was ironic was that I had been speaking to him half an hour earlier, and he looked very stable. He was there with his whole family, his grandchildren, his children. And what happened was, in his case, he unfortunately started to bleed massively in his lungs, and there was nothing anyone could do to save him.
Now, you have been studying near-death experiences for years now on a scientific plane. Has that created problems with colleagues? I mean, do they tell you, hey, this is too spiritual, stay away from this?
Well, this is exactly what happened to me. I graduated in medical school after that, and I decided that I really wanted to research this objectively and find out. And what I realized was that there had been almost no research in this field objectively, other than a few case reports. And that essentially the scientific community and the medical community pretty much poo-pooed the subject, and they considered it to be an area that was not even worthy of scientific research. Yet from my perspective, of course, this was a scientific entity. This is what happens to people when they die. And I used to come across a lot of resistance from people who would think that this shouldn't be studied by medicine, and that I certainly shouldn't be doing it as a junior doctor. And of course, I think a lot of people have found this, that there was often some resistance in even allowing this sort of thing to happen. But to my mind, it was very important that this is done scientifically rather than just be debated. And I've tried to persevere essentially the last 12 years or so.
In cases of near-death experiences, in many of the cases, even though they get to death's door, some people do cross over for a little bit, don't they? And they actually die?
Well, you see, near-death experiences had been reported for many years. They were, in fact, first reported by Raymond Moody in 1975. Mm-hmm. And what he found was that a lot of people who come close to death seem to have this sensation of going beyond a point of no return, and they feel that if they go beyond that, they can't come back again. The difficulty, though, with this whole term and concept of near-death experience was that it was too vague, and it was very difficult to know scientifically what had happened to them objectively at that time? You know, had they really been close to death? How close to death, etc. So what we did was we started to look at people who had a cardiac arrest, and by definition, these people had really died. And what we found is that actually we can bring a group of these people back to life after they had died. And so objectively, we were studying a group of people who really had entered the first phase of death. And so, yes, we found that people had died and had been brought back after they had died, and some of them had these incredible experiences.
It truly is fascinating. And, you know, as I was introducing you, Sam, you know, the older we get, the more interested we become in death. Or, you know, my parents, 87, 82, you know, they can't, God, I wish they could, but they can't go on forever, at least in this plane of existence. And you become more fascinated, I think, you know, the older you get with death and near-death experiences. Do you find that to be the case, too?
I think so. I absolutely think so. I mean, as I said, when I started this work, you know, I was in my early 20s. Now I'm almost 40 myself. And I think that your whole perspective on life changes. And I've noticed that patients of mine who are even older than myself, who are in their 60s or more, you do start, as you get older, you do start to think of life and death in a more concrete manner. And I think it takes on more significance because we all realize that whether we like it or not, life is temporary. And it's important to find out what does happen to us because it's an inevitable fact that we're going to go through. And in many people's cases, like myself, you know, loved ones have unfortunately passed away. And it's, I think, imperative that at least science tries to provide some answers to us in an objective, non-biased manner that will help all of us.
Absolutely. Now, tell me about your studies. How do you set that up?
Well, when I first got involved with this field, I reviewed all the literature that was out there. And I realized that there are essentially three broad views proposed for why near-death experiences may occur. The first of these was that the so-called predominantly scientific view that was sort of perceived as being scientific out there, which is that these experiences, although occurring, may be some sort of hallucination due to a chemical change in the brain, such as a lack of oxygen. The second viewpoint was that these may be some sort of psychological phenomena. So people who think that they're about to die start to imagine something pleasant to comfort themselves. And the third view, which was less scientifically thought to be credible, shall we say, was that maybe what people describe, at least of having an out-of-body experience, of being at the ceiling and looking at themselves, is real. That people really are, as they claim, able to see things from the ceiling. And so when I started my research, I decided to find out if any of these views may be correct. And so what we did was, we started a pilot study at the University of Southampton in England where we followed everyone who had a cardiac arrest, in other words, who died and who was resuscitated back to life again. And we looked at these three variables in terms of determining whether there was any relationship with chemicals in the body. We looked at oxygen and carbon dioxide levels and drugs that patients had been given. In terms of determining if this was some sort of psychological phenomena, we looked at patients' own cultural and religious background to see if there was any relationship with what they experienced, because some people have proposed that maybe these patients are imagining something pleasant based upon their own religious views to comfort themselves.
Right.
And the third view was that maybe these are real out-of-body experiences. And so we started something incredible, which was to place images that were hidden from sight in different parts of the resuscitation areas within the hospital. So I spent most of my weekends and evenings installing 150 shelves that were hanging from different areas of the hospital in case patients were to have a cardiac arrest, survive, and then, you know, claim to have an out-of-body experience. And that's essentially the sort of model that we established, you know, over 10 years ago now. And that's what I've been working on but expanding upon since that time.
Are you starting to get really startling results, results that would make the world go, oh, my gosh?
Well, the first research that we did essentially demonstrated that the methodology was feasible, but the problem is that the patients that we study, obviously they have died, and most of them can't be brought back to life again. And at that time, nobody really even knew what the percentage of patients would be who would have these experiences. So there was a lot of anecdotal experience out there that people claim to have out-of-body experiences. But really, doing it in a prospective study, nobody knew how frequently the experience will occur. in that study, nobody claimed to have an out-of-body experience, and so nobody could see the pictures. Now, fast-forwarding many years, we launched the AWARE study eventually after many years of me trying to get funding for a multi-center study, realizing that the only way we could do this would be in, you know, 20, 25 hospitals. And that study was established eventually in 2008. We don't have results yet, but we hope to be able to release those in about 18 months or so from now.
And primarily, are you using subjects who have had cardiac arrest, and is that different from someone who had a heart attack?
Absolutely. It's very important, actually, I think, to emphasize this, because most people, as I said, when they talk about near-death experience, as I'm sure you're aware and I'm sure your listeners are aware, there's a lot of debate and controversy that comes about. And part of that is because the whole term near-death, at least from a scientific perspective, is very vague. If you think about it, what do we mean by that? Is it someone who had a heart attack? Well, a lot of people who have heart attacks don't necessarily come close to death. A lot of people may have severe infections that may, you could hypothesize, could potentially lead to death, but they don't necessarily get close to it. Because obviously, as soon as they enter hospital, our goal is to prevent them from getting that close to death.
Right. And some people even have heart attacks and don't even know they had one.
Exactly. A lot of people have heart attacks, they don't know they've had it. A lot of people get. So, you know, there's no single condition that you could say absolutely means someone was close to death. And therefore, it caused a lot of, you know, I would say scientific chaos, because people then say, well, somebody could have had a near-death experience, but they weren't close to death, and is that really a near-death experience? And it just became very difficult. So cardiac arrest is, in my mind, the best model to study what happens when people die, because, in fact, it is scientifically the same as death, and people don't realize that. Cardiac arrest is not the same as a heart attack. A heart attack is when someone has, say, a clot that blocks blood going into the heart, and so a part of the heart muscle dies. That's a heart attack. A cardiac arrest is when the heart actually stops for different reasons. It could be a heart attack, but it could be that they've, for example, had a massive infection. Mm-hmm. It could be that they've had a massive clot in the lungs, a PE, or it could be due to numerous other conditions. But essentially, it is death, and it's the first stage of death. So it's important for research purposes because from a biological perspective, it is exactly what happens when people die. But as we've learned, death in the first phase is reversible. And so that's essentially the time that we try to study what happens to the mind and consciousness, essentially when people have died, say in the first few minutes, tens of minutes, the hour or so after death. And so we get a unique window of understanding into what happens to the mind and consciousness during that first period of death. And that's why we study cardiac arrest, as opposed to just any type of near-death experience.
When technicians or doctors are putting those electric pads on someone and you're trying to jumpstart the heart, is that generally because of cardiac arrest?
That's one of the reasons, yes, exactly, is a cardiac arrest, because we're trying to jumpstart the heart. That's the whole goal of managing someone who's had a cardiac arrest, is to try to restart the heart after somebody has died, because essentially death is defined when the heart stops and then a person stops breathing and the brain shuts down, and this all happens within a few seconds. And so we try to restart the heart and essentially get blood flowing back into the organs and prevent them from having permanent damage. So really, for all intents and purposes, cardiac arrest and death are essentially the same terms. When we're dealing with someone and trying to restart the heart, we happen to call it a cardiac arrest. When we don't, or if someone did not want to have that treatment, then we just call it death. But it's biologically, it's the same process.
At this point, what can you say about those people in the study or past studies who have had cardiac arrest? Do they all have near-death experiences, just a short amount, a small percentage?
Well, one of the things that our initial pilot study showed, and the research I've done so far confirms it too, as well as a number of other studies that were carried out by independent researchers such as Dr. Pim van Lommel and a couple of other researchers as well, have shown that essentially 10 to 20% of patients who have died, in other words, had a cardiac arrest and been brought back to life, will recall some kind of cognitive or mental activity. And typically, it's consistent with what has been described as a near-death experience. So they describe feeling peaceful, seeing a light, seeing deceased relatives, sometimes going to a beautiful place, sometimes going to a point where they feel that they have to come back. And sometimes having an instantaneous panoramic review, and also a proportion of them have what's called an out-of-body experience. This is very interesting because one of the questions that comes up is, well, how come only 10 to 20% of people have these experiences? What happens to the rest? And
right.
of course, we don't, right now, we don't know scientifically exactly what happens. It could be that really only 10 to 20% of people have the experience and, you know, 80, 90% just don't have it. Or it could be that everyone has the experience, but somehow a proportion of those people recall the experience, a bit like a dream. If you think about it, we all dream, but we only recall a small proportion of our dreams the following day. And it may be that that's happening. And there is some growing evidence that suggests that might be the case. And the reason is clear, because these people have gone through death, and there's been no blood flow to the brain, and the brain is in a severely traumatized state where the cells are undergoing tremendous change, and they're essentially going through the process of their own death. And so one wouldn't expect anyone to have recollections.
Right.
Even if they had experiences, you wouldn't expect them to be able to recall it. And so it may be that somehow there's something that's different about the people who are able to recall it, but everyone has the experience. But in the same way that some people are more vivid dreamers and they can recall their dreams more vividly than others, they're somehow able to recall their experiences more.
Doctor, of the 10 to 20% that recall this, what do they describe?
They tend to describe the same things as Raymond Moody had found in his original work, where he studied people who'd come close to death for whatever reason. And that was a very loose term that he used at that time. But they seem to describe this very profound sense of feeling comfortable, feeling peaceful. They describe a sense of not being afraid. And interestingly, many of them we find, although they have no memories of what happened to them before or even after the incident, they have this recollection, this type of near-death experience is very vivid and real for them. They then may go on to describe a sensation of seeing a very warm, bright, welcoming light that draws the person towards them. In many cases, they describe a sensation of seeing deceased relatives almost coming to welcome them. And sometimes they may even see a being of light, a being that's full of love and compassion that comforts them through the experience. And in some cases, they may have a sensation of almost judging themselves and their actions from during their lifetime in association or with the help of this being of light in a loving, compassionate way, where they learn what they have done, and sometimes they feel the pain that their actions or their intentions may have caused others. And this is interesting because what they describe at this time is that their experiences are very transparent. There is nothing between them, so they can't hide anything. And sometimes they get, you know, upset by what they've done to other people. But if they go on further, they may describe going to a very beautiful, heavenly type of place, a garden sometimes. And they may then describe a sensation of getting to a point where there's something symbolic that tells them if they go beyond that, they can't come back again. So it may be a stream, maybe a river, maybe a gate, maybe a fence, something that they feel if they go beyond that, they can't come back. They may then be told by this being of light or their deceased relatives, say a father or mother, that they have to go back. Or sometimes it could be their own thought. For example, a mother who has small children might think, well, I must go and take care of my children, and then they suddenly find themselves back in the body. And I think, as well as that, people have sometimes an instantaneous panoramic review of their entire life. So they may describe experiencing and feeling everything that they had done from early childhood up till that point and that moment as if flashing by in front of them.
It's fascinating, too, because of these visitations from relatives. We're going to come up to a break pretty soon, and I want to get more into that. And also, of the people that have come back, have you been able to track at this point, Sam, what they are like in their personalities? I mean, maybe they were mean people before this happened. Do they come back a little more enlightened?
Well, a lot of people become very transformed by the experience. And this is one of the things that was confirmed by Dr. Pim van Lommel's study, that people who have these near-death experiences, and I think from my own experience, especially if they've seen a being of light, they're much more positively affected by it.
All right, let's find out a little bit more about
changes.
That. We'll come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're talking about near-death experiences and studies. We're with Dr. Sam Parnia, and we are getting into this in a big, big way. It's a topic, of course, that really strikes home for me as well. Sam, a few years ago, a friend of mine died in a motorcycle accident. And at the funeral, you go up there and look at the body, which I don't like to do, but I did. And, you know, I think it's probably very natural for all of us, as you're looking at this dead person, to think, what are they doing now? Where are they? What's the other side like? Is there, maybe there's nothing there? And they're baffling questions. Have you come away from this yet at this point where you can say, even for yourself, there's something on the other side?
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I think that we all have this. And I've, like you, you know, I've lost people that I was close to, as well as patients that I got to know on a personal level. And of course, one is confronted with that question. And I think it's something that's fascinated humankind from the beginning of time. Scientifically, I think what we are discovering essentially is that the boundaries between life and death are being eroded more and more through resuscitation science. And so we don't, it's difficult to even tell. I mean, although we have a way that we define death, but it's really difficult to know now because we know that we can reverse death for a period of time. And so you could argue that actually a period of time after death is reversible. And so there is even some sort of, from a physical perspective, some sort of afterlife remaining. But essentially, in terms of the big question of, you know, is there something that remains of us, say, you know, for a long time or eternity, or I'm not sure really how long people perceive it to be. Of course, we don't yet know. But what has been discovered is that at least in the early stage of death, the period that we can study up to the first hour or so or more of death, the human mind and consciousness, that part that makes us into who we are, that gives us our personality, our every sort of aspect of what makes me into who I am and you into who you are, seems to continue to exist. And I think that's very significant to appreciate.
Tell us about this transformation that you see in some of these patients.
Well, it's very interesting because it's difficult to give a sort of one-size-fits-all approach to this. But in general, what I've noticed from people that I have interviewed myself, because as well as doing these prospective research studies into cardiac arrest patients, I also collected, like many other researchers, people's experiences from all over really. And I had more than 500 or so cases that I studied. And what I found is that essentially people's perception of life seems to change after they've come back when they've had these near-death experiences, particularly if they've encountered a being of light. Somehow it seems to be that that whole experience, in particular that being of light, has affected them really significantly, such that they their value systems have changed. So they see life as more an opportunity to do good. They become more altruistic. They're less engaged in themselves. They're less selfish, less self-centered, more interested in helping family and community, less materialistic. Essentially happier, more content people with what they have, and certainly less afraid of death. And in most cases, I'll be honest with you, not afraid of death at all. They seem to feel from their perspective that they've seen what death is like. They've seen that it wasn't unpleasant. And I'm just going to give a side note to that. Obviously not people, for example, who've tried to commit suicide or had some sort of traumatic suicide event, something, putting aside the exceptions. People who died out of natural causes seem to have found the experience to have been nothing to be afraid of, and in fact, in many cases, so pleasant that they ideally didn't want to come back. And so they're really not afraid of death at all, and it gives them a new perspective on life, which I find fascinating. And there are people who maybe started out without any kind of belief system, without having this approach, but having had the experience, they've changed and they've become transformed, at least from what I can say, in a much better way for themselves.
That is remarkable. And though I'm sure they don't want to die, they're not afraid to die anymore.
They're not afraid to die anymore. And that is a very important point to point out. And one other thing that I actually should just say here is that some people, of course, could argue that maybe the whole incident of actually dying or coming close to death and coming back to life could leave you with a profound impact. You know, of course, even if someone comes close to death but doesn't have an experience, you may expect them to be transformed by that. And what was found by a study carried out by the Dutch cardiologist, Dr. Pim van Lommel, was that essentially he studied all the patients in his hospital, or group of 10 hospitals, I should say, who'd had cardiac arrest, in other words, who died and who'd been brought back to life again. And although he did found some impact on those who didn't have an experience, those who had a near-death experience were significantly more transformed by their experience than those who didn't, suggesting that this transformation was something to do with the what we call the near-death experience, the experience they'd had, those encounters, rather than just the mere fact of having come close to death.
Sam, tell me about this light in the relatives that they see when they've crossed over. They seem to all come back to help their, you know, dearly departed one, their new one, and either to convince them to move back, get over there, get back in your body. Is the relative generally someone who is pretty close to them when they were alive for the moment?
Yes, generally it's someone that they have been close to, and usually it's someone who's passed away before them. So often it may be a mother or a father. It may, of course, be others that they were close to, but typically I found that it's often a parent who essentially seems to comfort them. And what's interesting is there is this other phenomena that you may be aware of, the deathbed visions, where hospital workers, say hospice workers, and it's different to a near-death experience, but essentially they've observed patients who are dying, who are not going to be revived in this case. These are not patients who are going to be resuscitated. These are just patients who have, let's say, terminal cancer and who are not supposed to be revived. But when they're in a hospice and they're dying, often people who work around them have noticed that in the 24 hours prior to their death, they seem to develop this sense of lucidity where they are encountering beings of light. And often it seems to be their relatives. It's my own wife, actually, her aunt died a number of years ago, and she tells me that she saw her, and she suddenly said to her family who were by her bedside, and she hadn't spoken for days, suddenly said, "Don't worry, they're all here." And so it's interesting, when you talk to people, often people have come across, you know, their own loved ones who've had this experience, and it seems to be relatives who come to comfort people through the process of death.
Do they ever come across something evil, like the devil, instead of, one of their loved ones?
In the research that I have done, I have never come across this. As I said, I've personally interviewed hundreds of people who had near-death experiences, as well as carrying out research into people who objectively have died in cardiac arrest. There are some reports where people have reported so-called negative near-death experience. Those are much more difficult to study because they're much rarer. And as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, the whole concept of what is a near-death, what is near-death from a biomedical perspective is very difficult to quantify. And so, of course, we know that when people are ill for any reason in hospital and they're given drugs or various other compounds, they can have all kinds of experiences. And then, of course, what you have is someone who reports, 10 years later that I had a negative near-death experience and I'm sure I had it. But it's almost impossible in every case to determine what was really happening to them. So there are reports of people who have, persecutory type of experiences where they may describe, rats, snakes, something negative happening to them. But as I said, these are simply anecdotes, and it's very difficult to know whether they really were close to death or not. In the studies that have been, there are 5 published scientific articles and studies that have looked at patients in cardiac arrest, those who objectively have died, and none of them have reported these so-called near-death type of experiences. So I think the field is open. We obviously need to do much more research, and there are very few researchers out there who are working in this field. But in those objective prospective studies, we've never come across them.
And they don't talk about a heaven or hell or anything like that?
Well, that is a very interesting question you ask, because obviously we, i.e. those of us who haven't died, are, to a greater or lesser extent, are brought up with concepts of a heaven or a hell, whether some people believe in them or not, but at least we've all heard about it to some extent. What is interesting about these people who have near-death experience is that their experiences don't seem to mimic, to a large extent, what we are taught about what should happen when we die. For example, if you think about it, religious teaching doesn't tell us, traditionally at least, about having a near-death experience. In other words, it doesn't tell you that when you die, you're going to go through, a tunnel, see a bright light, you may see deceased relatives. It doesn't seem to follow that whole thing. So they describe essentially what they, as I've described before, what they experience. They don't necessarily talk about it in the sense of heaven or hell, although if they did believe in a heaven, they may associate it with that heaven they believed in. So, for example, and that's a general point, people's interpretation of their experience does depend on what they believed beforehand, as I guess you could argue any experience that we have depends on what we believe beforehand. So, for example, if someone is a Christian and they see a being of light, they may say that they saw Christ. But actually, if you push them and you say, well, how do you know it was Christ? They say, well, I don't know, but it was, I saw this being that I would have always imagined Christ would have been like. And if they're, say, a Hindu, they may describe seeing a being of light, and they suddenly call it one of the Hindu deities, let's say Krishna.
Sure.
And when you push them, you realize, actually, well, it may be they're seeing the same thing, but they're interpreting it based on what they believe. And this becomes really clear when you study children's near-death experiences, children who've often been too young to have any concept of life or death, let alone heaven or hell, say less than 3 years old, 4 years old. And their interpretation, they seem to have the same experience as the adults, but the way they describe it is in children's terms and based upon their own terminology and vocabulary. So it may be that there's more of a universal experience, but the interpretation depends on the individual.
Does anyone, doctor, come back with psychic abilities, abilities that they did not have before they passed over?
The people that I've studied, I have never seen this, but I'm sure there may be some anecdotal reports in that way. I haven't personally come across it, though, I must be honest.
There must be some connection, though, with that. Now, let's see, you've got the kind of study where I want you to be right. I want you to be able to prove that there is a life after death. I mean, who wants to believe that there's nothing once we go? I mean, what a horrible thing to think. What are the percents? What's the percent, do you think, that it does exist, if you had to give a percent for it?
Well, you know, it's very hard for me. People often ask me, and they sort of say, what's your personal view about this? What do you think is happening? And honestly, it's very difficult because I, from a very young age, have been sort of almost ingrained in this, and I've heard all the different arguments from all the different sort of perspectives, and my own opinions have changed as I've gone along, and I'm growing along with it. And so I've come to a point where actually I realize I honestly, as a scientist and a researcher, don't know. What I do know is what evidence we have so far, and I can definitely summarize that, which is essentially that the whole concept of what we are, or in other words, the mind and consciousness, that entity that gives us sense of who we are, doesn't seem to disintegrate after people have died, at least not in the first phase of death. The first hour or two after someone has died, it still seems to be in existence, and I think that's important to realize. Now, there are many people out there that I've spoken to who will tell you that I believe, from their perspective, I believe that when you die, that's it, there's nothing. Well, we definitely can say that doesn't seem to be true anymore because we have crossed over that boundary of death. And we've gone beyond that by many minutes to hours. And what we have demonstrated is essentially the mind and consciousness does not cease to exist at the moment of death. Can I tell you that it exists 5,000 years later? At this point, of course I can't, because my scientific abilities and tools are limited to the first hour or two after death. But at least in that time, there is something that remains after people have crossed over the boundary of death and gone to the other side. It's intriguing to follow it further and find out what happens later, and that's obviously something that we're interested in doing.
Tell me about the Switzerland study. What are they doing there?
Well, again, partly is there are very few researchers out there who study near-death experiences, and there are some who have tried to essentially prove that this is an illusion in some way, which is very difficult to do, and to my mind sometimes has been a negative type of research. There is some work that's come from Switzerland a few years ago where a group of researchers demonstrated that a patient who was having some treatment for epilepsy, and what they were doing was, so this person was having intractable epilepsy episodes, and they were trying to track in the brain what parts of the brain may be involved with this epilepsy or seizures that this patient was having. And apparently they demonstrated when they stimulated a particular part of the brain that in this one individual, that she claimed to be having some sort of what may have been described as an out-of-body-like experience, where she seemed to feel that she was able to see half of her body. And so this led to the perception that maybe all out-of-body experiences are therefore illusory because they could stimulate a type of out-of-body experience. Of course, when you study the paper, you realize that it doesn't seem to be a typical out-of-body experience. For example, this lady didn't say that she separated from herself and was able to see things from below as a typical out-of-body experience is. And then what has been done is, and this is where I unfortunately, I completely disagree with the research, a study was published a couple of years ago which received worldwide coverage claiming that out-of-body experiences have been proven and that they're basically illusory. And this was done by a group of Swiss researchers where essentially they took people and they placed a camera behind. So they had a person sit on a chair, they put a camera behind them, and they recorded them from behind. And then they also covered the eyes with a particular goggle that the person who was sitting there couldn't see anything from outside, and all they could see through the goggle was what the camera was showing. In other words, the camera who was focused on their back.
On the back of the head, okay.
Right? And so they did that for a number of hours, and after a while, they then demonstrated that if they moved towards the camera, the person felt that the movement was being done towards them. So, for example, if they attacked the camera with a hammer, the person would have a startle response, thinking that they're being attacked themselves. So everything that they saw through the goggles, in other words, the camera, they thought was real. And they claimed that this was an out-of-body experience, and that they had been able to replicate an out-of-body experience in the laboratory. Of course, the problem is that this is a clear visual illusion that they had created, and none of these people had what we know, at least, as an out-of-body experience. In other words, going to the ceiling and looking at themselves from above and the way that people have described it. And so it doesn't seem to be the same thing, and that's part of why I mentioned at the beginning it's very important scientifically to be accurate about what we are studying, and in other words, study people who have objectively died and to study what they experienced at that time. Otherwise, these type of sort of visual illusions can be created, but they're not necessarily the same thing. And so I think it's important for people to realize that it's almost like we're looking at apples and oranges. They're not the same thing at all.
If you factor in what you've been studying over the years and all these reports from a lot of credible people, ghost stories, spirits, and factor both of them in, then you might have to conclude that there's something on the other side. I think in tandem with your study, doctor, if there could be from some other organization a study on the perception of ghosts and the believability of ghosts, it might give you a scientific basis to conclude that when we die, we go to a different plane of existence, but some of us don't because we're confused. So we hang around, i.e. being the ghost. But that would tell you, I think, definitively that there's something going on because it can be approached in a different way too. With both studies, I think, being critically important. What do you think?
Well, I think you raised a number of interesting points, which, to be honest with you, again, as I said, I've been so sort of intrigued by the subject that I've been studying different aspects of it. And one of the things I have been studying is the whole perception of what is the mind, what is the soul, what is the spirit. And these are terms that people use all the time. And sometimes it's very hard as a scientist to know what they mean by that.
I want to get your take on what is a soul when we come back, Sam. We've got 2 hours left to go with you, and we're going to be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.